right, decisions. That's right. We're going to jump into things today because we need to be making a lot of decisions in the world today. This is going to be a really important show. In the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Julie Mitchell, managing attorney at Caresen, and Evelyn Hernandez, a TPS holder, temporary protective status holder and organizer. And we're going to be talking with them about the Trump regime's latest decision to end temporary protected status for Salvadoran immigrants. All right. So this is extremely important for people to stick around and listen to. But opening the show up, I'm really, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this for a long time. When you look at what's been happening in the world, there's really, I think you really have to have your eyes closed, your ears filled with whatever to stop you from hearing. You have to be burying your head somewhere in the dirt to not recognize just how dangerous things are getting, how much it means, whether it's the slimy little things that Trump keeps spitting out of his mouth day after day, but the reality, not just what he says, but the reality that that creates the ground for, the reality that that backs up and that makes it a situation where we can have hundreds of thousands of people being kicked out of the country, people who are going to be sent back to places where they starve, where we can have Trump talking about, why can't we just nuke them? Why can't we just nuke them? Look at what's happening in the world. And because of that, I really wanted to make sure that we listen to, and I'm going to dedicate a half an hour each week for the next 2 weeks, this week and next week, for people to hear a speech by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And we're going to be listening today to the first half of the talk, "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible." So once again, this is Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And he's talking about, you know, it's something, if you don't think we're in fascism, if you don't think that's true, you need to listen to this even more. And if you do think it's true, you need to listen to this to get a good orientation and understanding of what's happening and what we need to do about it. All right? So without any further ado, this is Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party.
The Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible. We are confronted by, we are now being ruled by, a fascist regime, relentlessly assaulting civil rights and liberties and openly promoting bigotry and inequality, acting with callous disregard or cold-blooded malice toward those they consider inferior and a drain or stain on the country, on a mission to deny health care to millions who will suffer and many who will die without it, crudely degrading women as objects of plunder, breeders of children without the right to abortion or birth control, subordinate to husbands and men in general, defying the science of climate change, attacking the science of evolution, and repudiating the scientific method overall. A regime brandishing an arsenal of mass destruction and threatening nuclear war, intensifying state terror against Muslims, immigrants, and people in the inner cities, unleashing and giving encouragement and support to brutal thugs spewing vile America first, white supremacist, male supremacist, and anti-LGBT venom. A regime that boasts of all this and declares its intention to do even worse. This has caused disgust, anger, and agonizing among huge numbers of people. And there have been many important acts of resistance, big and small, to the continuing outrages committed by this regime and its supporters. But the regime remains in power and is determined to ride roughshod over all obstacles to carry out its monstrous agenda. And the need for a massive outpouring of people, acting together nonviolently but with sustained determination to create a political situation where this regime cannot remain in power, cries out. The organization Refuse Fascism, refusefascism.org, has put forward a call and a plan and is actively building for that mass mobilization to begin on November 4. So this is the challenge we are facing. To meet this challenge, there are big questions that need to be seriously engaged, even as people are moving to build momentum toward November 4. Donald Trump claims to have won the popular vote in the 2016 election. That is another of his big lies. But the fact is, it would have been a disgrace if just 10 people voted for this, or 10,000, but tens of millions did. Why? The fundamental answer lies in the whole history of this country and its role in the world. Did you know that the Constitution adopted by the founders of this country institutionalized the right of men to rape at will? I had thought of beginning this talk with that statement. And then, in response to the gasp of shock and disbelief that such a statement should call forth, I could have said, no, the Constitution didn't actually do that. But it did something no less horrific, institutionalizing the enslavement of millions of people. In fact, however, the Constitution adopted by the founders did legalize mass rape. Besides enshrining property relations in which men could legally rape their wives, the Constitution, by explicitly codifying the status of slaves as property, in effect established the right of the slave owners to do anything they wish to their slaves, including raping the women. And slave women were raped regularly and repeatedly by their owners and overseers. Often, people who do not want to face the reality and the implications of this will argue, we have to judge things by the standards of the time. People back then did not know better. As they say in England, rubbish. For one thing, the slaves knew better. And there is the example of Edward Coles, who before becoming governor of Illinois was private secretary to James Madison, the main author of the U.S. Constitution. Coles freed his own slaves and tried to convince Madison and Thomas Jefferson, author of the Declaration of Independence, to do the same. They refused. But you can't say nobody knew better back then. It is true, Madison and Jefferson, and yes, Hamilton, belong to a past time, and it is long past time that we move beyond what they represent. The terrible truth is that with some notable exceptions, including the very significant exception of the generation that came of age in the 1960s, white people overall have either been directly involved in or have supported or at least passively accepted all this throughout the history of this country. During the whole time of slavery, during the decades of Jim Crow segregation and Ku Klux Klan terror, when repeatedly black people, in particular black men, who did not know their place, or perhaps sometimes without even knowing why, angered some white person, would be lynched while crowds of white people would gather in a picnic atmosphere, vying to get parts of the mutilated body of the black person hanging from a tree. And photographs of this were turned into postcards that were sold throughout the country. Yes, this is true. An ugly, shameful truth. Today, with the repeated murders of black people by police, in the rare instances when the murdering cop is actually indicted, there are white people who sit on juries and refuse to convict. And still too many white people who claim to care about justice and will take to social media to denounce far less outrageous and sometimes even trivial acts cannot find it in themselves to be outraged and moved to act about this. If the police wantonly shot down dogs over and over again, there would be a huge outcry throughout society, including from people who are silent or make excuses, when this is done to human beings of darker skin. Now, it would be wrong and harmful to ignore the fact that there are white people, in particular younger white people, but others as well, who have taken to the streets to protest these murders and who have put forward the stand, white silence is violence. It is complicity in murder. This is, of course, a good thing, and it needs to happen much more on a much greater scale. But given the actual history of this country down to today, does it really make sense to insist, as some people still stubbornly do, that fascism couldn't happen here, not in this country, with our democracy and our great traditions? It is, however, very important to dig into the question, how did things come to this point where we are confronting the real horror of a fascist America? Here, told briefly, is the longer story, the broader history that has led to this. Thousands of years ago, human beings who had lived for tens of thousands of years before in small hunting and gathering societies settled on land and carried out farming and domestication of animals, particularly in the Fertile Crescent of the Eastern Mediterranean and Middle East areas. With this came the emergence of class division, the polarization between rich and poor, powerful and powerless, including the patriarchal oppression of women by men. As this way of life spread and took hold in large parts of the world, ancient civilizations and empires arose. For example, in India, Egypt, China, Persia, Greece, and Rome, and then centuries later, the Islamic Empire, covering a large territory in the Middle East and parts of Asia, Africa, and Europe. While built on plunder and oppression, they nevertheless brought forth many great achievements in architecture, art, music, the development of language and literature, science, and other spheres. But the history of the rise of empires has also been the history of their decline and fall, because of contradictions and conflicts within them, and because of invasions from outside forces, themselves driven by their own contradictions, conflicts, and challenges. This went on for thousands of years, but then, several hundred years ago, something dramatically new emerged, the development of the capitalist system. This is a far more dynamic system than previously existed in human history, a system driven by its own internal contradictions to constantly expand, to continually transform the technological basis on which it operates, to repeatedly intensify the exploitation of people on which its profits rest. And again, as a result of the contradictions and conflicts within and between different countries and the rise and fall of different powers, it just so happened that it was mainly in Europe that capitalism first took hold and emerged as a dominant force on the world stage. This was accomplished in its very foundation through the most horrendous means. Karl Marx, the founder of communism, described with bitter irony the rosy dawn of capitalism. The massive hunting of slaves in Africa, shipping them in chains in the millions to be worked mercilessly in the Americas. The conquest of the original peoples in South America and their enslavement unto death in the gold and silver mines there, and atrocities of a similar kind that fed countless human beings in far-flung parts of the world into the relentless machinery of an ever-expanding capitalism. This, as well as brutal exploitation, including child labor, within these capitalist countries themselves, was the basis on which Western civilization made leaps in its development and became the dominating force in the world, economically, militarily, politically, and culturally. Capitalism, through all the horrors it has brought about, including two world wars and countless other armed conflicts, has in fact laid the basis for a whole new leap beyond relations of exploitation and oppression and the madness of war and environmental destruction. But at the same time, and this is now posed in very stark and acute terms, this system of capitalism stands as the greatest obstacle to this advance. And human society everywhere is straining against the confines in which capitalism continues to enchain human existence. This puts in proper perspective and sharply refutes the racist notion of the superiority of Western, that is, white European civilization, and the idea that somehow capitalism is the highest form of existence that human beings can attain and should aspire to.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're listening to the first half of a speech given by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, last fall. And this speech is about the Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible.
And here is the shorter story. The more particular reasons why things have come to this crossroads in this country with potentially disastrous consequences for human beings everywhere. The USA is a country which established its territory and built the foundation of its wealth through the armed conquest of land, genocide, slavery, and ruthless exploitation of successive waves of immigrants to America. And it has continued as a country marked by white supremacy, patriarchy and male supremacy, and other oppressive divisions, while expanding its domination into an empire stretching across the globe, sitting atop a lopsided world of profound inequalities and plunder of the environment. It would take the resources of nearly five Earths for the rest of the world to have the kind of consumer society that exists in the U.S. All this backed up and enforced by a massive machinery of death and devastation, the U.S. military, and reinforced with a constant barrage of ideas and culture, rationalizing and justifying all this oppression and destruction, propagated through an equally massive machinery of molding public opinion. Today, while the U.S. is, and loudly proclaims itself to be, the world's number one superpower, it is riddled with sharpening contradictions and facing growing challenges within the country and internationally. And this has brought forth a fascist regime that now holds the reins of power with the finger of a demented bully on the nuclear button. A regime that, without exaggeration, threatens not just greatly heightened suffering for the masses of humanity, but the very existence of humanity itself. So this poses sharply the immediate urgent challenge we face. Calling this regime fascist is not an insult, but speaks to the terrible reality. On the website revcom.us, this explanation regularly appears. Fascism is the exercise of blatant dictatorship by the bourgeois capitalist imperialist class, ruling through reliance on open terror and violence, trampling on what are supposed to be civil and legal rights, wielding the power of the state, and mobilizing organized groups of fanatical thugs to commit atrocities against masses of people, particularly groups of people identified as enemies, undesirables, or dangers to society. At the same time, and this can be seen through studying the examples of Nazi Germany and Italy under Mussolini, while it will likely move quickly to enforce certain repressive measures in consolidating its rule, a fascist regime is also likely to implement its program overall through a series of stages and even attempt at different points to reassure the people or certain groups among the people that they will escape the horrors if they quietly go along and do not protest or resist while others are being terrorized and targeted for repression, deportation, conversion, prison, or execution. Refuse Fascism has published as a pamphlet and posted on refusefascism.org material that can be made into portable panels outlining the outrages already committed by the Trump-Pence regime, as well as what they are preparing to do and what they have called forth from the thugs they have encouraged and unleashed in their attacks on Muslims, immigrants, civil liberties, women and LGBTQ people, on the environment and on the people of the world, and what they have done to reinforce and fortify white supremacy, police brutality, and mass incarceration. It is very striking how far things have already gone and how much worse they are bound to get if this regime is allowed to remain in power and fully implement its agenda. One of the most distinguishing and significant features of this particularly American version of fascism is the unholy alliance between Trump and fundamentalist Christian fascists. As I pointed out in another recent talk, Trump, I think it's fair to say, could not have won the election if the Christian fascists not only had opposed him, but if they'd been unenthusiastic about him. And even when the pussy-grabbing thing came out, they didn't turn against him, Jerry Falwell Jr. and all these others, because they recognized, here is somebody who is going outside of the whole rules and the way things are done in the swamp of Washington, who will actually carry through on this stuff, like outlawing abortion and suppressing gay people. And Trump, for his part, recognized that if he didn't get this force behind him, he was not going to be able to do it. Pence is obviously a critical linchpin in this uniting of what's represented by Trump and the Christian fascists. The regular bourgeois institutions like CNN, the Democratic Party, and so on, they keep saying, he can't do that. That's not the way things are done. But then Trump does it because he's not playing by those rules. He's not working within the norms as they've been. He is going directly up against them, precisely as an important part of what he's doing. And while Pence plays a very important role in all this, he is far from the only Christian fascist in this regime. Besides the appointment of Neil Gorsuch, who is himself a Christian fascist, to the Supreme Court, reestablishing after the death of Antonin Scalia the right-wing majority on the court, Trump's cabinet is full of these Christian fascists. Perhaps it seems harsh or even extreme to refer to these fundamentalist Christians as fascists. Well, in Catherine Stewart's book, The Good News Club, The Christian Right's Stealth Assault on Americans' Children, she cites these comments by Rich Lang, himself a former Christian fundamentalist who broke with that and became a liberal Christian pastor. When I was born again, Lang recalls, faith was something inside of you, something you were supposed to reflect through your life. But in the 1980s, something happened. Fundamentalist Christianity jumped back into the public square with the intention to reshape the country as a Christian nation as defined by them. It's no different than the Nazis wanting to start with the Hitler Youth. That is where you'd want to start if you were trying to build a fascist movement. That's the word, fascism. Nobody likes to use it in this country. But I believe that in this country, underneath the appearances, that is exactly the great temptation of our time. And you have to call it what it is, Christian fascism. Stewart further summarizes Lang's views this way. Modern fundamentalism, like fascism in earlier times, he says, involves a strong feeling of persecution, typically at the hands of godless liberals or a religious other. The belief that one belongs to a pure race or national group that is responsible for past greatness, suffers unjust oppression in the present, and is the rightful ruler of the world. The impulse to submit unquestioningly to absolute authority, and the relentless drive for power and control. It is, he says, a kind of supremacist movement with religion rather than race at its core. And there is this chilling statement by Lang. People have no idea it's going on. What does it mean that the conservative church that's growing in America is an end times church? What does it mean that we are raising a generation of children to believe that they are the last generation? What is going to happen if we keep on telling them, don't care about the environment and bring on the war because we're going to be lifted out of here? And you can forget about loving your neighbors because they're just going to get blown away. So that is the insight of someone very familiar with these Christian fascists. And the fact is that in this country, with its whole history of genocide, slavery, and racism, any form of fascism, including one basing itself on Christian supremacy, any urge to restore past greatness cannot help but be bound together with white supremacy.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and today we're listening to the first half of a speech given by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, last fall. And this speech is about the Trump-Pence regime must go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. A better world is possible.
The Republican Party has been moving in a fascist direction since the late 1960s, with further leaps since then to becoming more and more openly fascist. And in running for president in 1968, Richard Nixon adopted what has been called the Southern Strategy, which the Republican Party has followed ever since. This is a direct appeal to white supremacy, to the racism of white people, particularly, though not only, in the southern states, who are enraged that black people are not staying in their place. The Republican Party is not the party of Lincoln, as it sometimes demagogically claims to be. It has become much more the party of the Confederacy. With Ronald Reagan, the Republican Party took another leap on the road of fascism. Reagan very deliberately began his campaign for president in 1980 in Philadelphia, Mississippi, where in 1964, three civil rights workers were kidnapped and brutally murdered by white supremacists. There, in Philadelphia, Mississippi, Reagan proclaimed his support for states' rights, which particularly in the South have long been code words for white supremacist lynch mobism. And after George W. Bush took things still further in a fascist direction, including the open use of torture and the active promotion of Christian fundamentalism, the Trump-Pence regime has made the leap into all-out fascism. There is a direct line from the Confederacy to the fascists of today, and a direct connection between their white supremacy, their open disgust and hatred for LGBT people as well as women, their willful rejection of science and the scientific method, their raw America First jingoism and trumpeting of the superiority of Western civilization, and their bellicose wielding of military power, including their expressed willingness and blatant threats to use nuclear weapons to destroy countries. The truth, another terrible truth that must be faced, is that in the context of profound and acute contradictions that are asserting or reasserting themselves in ways that are tearing at the very fabric and deepening cracks in the foundation of this country, at the same time as the American empire is facing serious challenges internationally, fascism is one possible resolution of this on the terms of this system and its ruling class, even as this is a horror for humanity. While the Constitution does establish the separation of church and state, and the Christian fascists are wrong or simply lying when they insist that the founding documents of this country established it as a Christian nation, the reality is that Christianity has all along been the unofficial state religion of this country, and the country's identity throughout its history has been as a white Christian nation, grounded in male supremacy as well as white supremacy, and driven by a manifest destiny to dominate not only the continent of North America, but ultimately the world as a whole. All this has been brought into question and has become the focus of intense struggle going back to the 1960s and in some important ways, back to the Civil War. And while developments internationally, including the demise of the Soviet Union, have given further impetus to the globalization of the capitalist world economy, this very heightened globalization has propelled changes that have sharpened contradictions within the U.S. as well as on a world level, particularly with an emerging capitalist China mounting a challenge to U.S. global economic dominance. At the same time as this heightened globalization, under conditions of Western imperialist domination, has wreaked havoc in countries throughout the Third World, including the Middle East and other places where Islam is the prevailing religion, adding fuel to a virulent Islamic fundamentalism that has declared war on the decadent West and on infidels and others oriented toward the West and facilitating its imperial domination. In order to bring about any positive resolution to all this, even short of abolishing and moving beyond this whole system, it is necessary and crucial to break with the normal routine and the normal workings of the political process. Paul Krugman, a Nobel Prize-winning economist, recently wrote that faced as we are with the gravity of the growing climate crisis, those now ruling us may end up destroying civilization because of their willful ignorance and opposition to the scientific method. This was said very seriously, and it is deadly serious. Speaking to this in a question, a challenge for Paul Krugman and all those concerned about the future of humanity, I emphasize the importance of refusing to simply hope that the normal workings of a process that has brought these people to their ruling position will somehow prevent them from acting in accordance with their willful ignorance and worse. I emphasize the importance of refusing to simply hope that the normal workings of a process that has brought these people to their ruling position will somehow prevent them from acting in accordance with their willful ignorance and worse. But why do many people still stubbornly cling to such false hopes? Thomas Frank is the liberal author of a book with the catchy title, What's the Matter with Kansas? How Conservatives Won the Heart of America. But the more important question is, what's the matter with liberals? Well, it is important, first of all, to draw the distinction between ruling class liberals and regular liberals. As for liberals of the ruling class, what is the matter with them is something I will get to shortly. But for those who are not part of the ruling class, the matter is that although they are willing to admit that there are real problems in this country and they would like to have a more just society and world, many resist recognizing the systematic and systemic nature of the injustices, and they fear the conflict, turmoil, and chaos that could be set loose by a determined struggle against this. Even as they do have a sense of the horrors that the Trump-Pence regime represents, too many are caught up in thinking that amounts to this. I am hoping, and by staying within the established norms, I am gambling on the hope that the horrors don't hit me and those I most care about. This, it has to be said, is politically as well as morally bankrupt and will only contribute to the impending disaster. It used to be a common saying, to the person of the right, order is more important than justice, while for the person of the left, it is the opposite. Now the question is put squarely to liberals and really to everyone. Which, after all, is more important? Order, even if that is the order of fascism, with everything that means? Or justice, even if that means stepping outside of our comfort zone and putting ourselves on the line to prevent this fascism from consolidating its rule and fully implementing its program? Another dangerous illusion is the notion that, particularly for black people, what is happening now is just more of the same. Yes, the history of this country is the history of unspeakable atrocities committed against black people as well as others. But what we are facing now with this fascist regime is the heightened possibility, not just that this oppression will be carried to genocidal extremes, and that the mass of people everywhere will be subjected to previously unseen horrors, but that the human species itself will be wiped out.
All right, welcome back. Remember, the human species itself could be wiped out, all right? And that was the first half of a talk given by Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And the talk is called "The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept the fascist America. A better world is possible." And folks, you know, look, just got to say, man, if you want to hear this, if you want to hear the whole speech, you want to hear this part again, you want to go and dig into the whole speech right away, you can do that at revcom.us. Once again, that's revcom.us. All right. And you'll find the speech there. This is something for everyone to dig into. It's really something for everyone to dig into. We are facing a hellified situation in the world. Billions of people, the entire globe is up against it. And we have got to take this very, very serious. As part of that, I really encourage people to listen to and study what Avakian's been saying. Nothing short of driving out this regime through mass sustained political resistance is going to end this nightmare. And millions of people want Trump and Pence gone. But the problem is they haven't acted in a commensurate way. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back to talk with Julie Mitchell and Evelyn Hernandez about El Salvador and what's going on. Welcome back. That was City of Immigrants from Steve Earle, all right? And it's very fitting for what we're going to be talking about now. You know, basically, people have been following the news. You've seen that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security announced on Monday that it's ending Temporary Protected Status, or TPS, for 200,000 Salvadoran refugees. Salvadorans under TPS now have 18 months to either change their immigration status or face deportation back to their home country of El Salvador. Many of them have been living in the U.S. for decades following an earthquake that killed over 1,000 people. Last fall, the Trump administration already had terminated TPS for 59,000 Haitians and 2,500 Nicaraguans, and it keeps bringing the axe down harder and harder across the board everywhere it goes. You know what Trump's about. You know what's going on there. And so I really want to welcome to the show my next guest. And unfortunately, I want to welcome my guest, Julie Mitchell, who's managing attorney at Crescent, and Evelyn Hernandez, who's a TPS holder and organizer. Julie, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Sure. Evelyn, welcome.
Thank you very much.
See, you got it straight there. You got it. nice and robust. There we go. So I want to just jump right into this. Let's talk about what is happening. People have seen, a lot of things on the news, and there's been a lot of back and forth, and everything's getting all mushed up together. But there's a real dangerous assault that's going on. So I wanted you to know if you could explain to people what's happening first. Julie.
Well, the most recent news that came down was earlier this week, the Trump administration had announced that they were going to end TPS for El Salvador. And El Salvador currently has over 263,000 TPS holders in the U.S. that have had TPS since the program was first announced in 2001. So this is a group of people who has had authorization to live and work in the U.S. for 17 years, and they've renewed that status every 18 months, gone through very thorough background checks. They're a highly vetted community, and they've just received news that their status will be terminated in 18 months.
Mm-hmm. Now, before we get into the whys and what's around that, let me ask you this, because this is a program that applies broadly across the board to many immigrants, particularly immigrants from the countries that have been oppressed and downpressed by the various major powers in the world, the imperial powers, U.S., Britain, Germany, all these places. All these people who have come into the U.S. or come anywhere to try and work, to try and deal with something, they're hit by this TPS. What does it mean to be in a TPS, be covered by TPS, the temporary protected status?
I mean, the most important thing is that it gives you permission to stay in the U.S. It protects you from deportation. It gives you a work permit so that you can work. So it's a significant benefit for lots and lots of people.
And what will it mean for people to lose that?
For a lot of people, it will mean losing their only legal option. There's going to be some of the TPS community that will be eligible for some other immigration relief. But for a lot of people, their lives are getting turned upside down. These are people that have lived here for a long time. They've had kids in the U.S. They're involved in the kids' schools. These are people with careers in the U.S. that have contributed significantly to the economy of the U.S., not to mention all of the Social Security, Medicare payments. These are people that have been here a long time, so to all of a sudden lose their status, it's significant.
And it's very interesting, too, and I think it's important for people to realize, too, that, look, it's not just that people have come here and they're providing, they're working hard and doing all this stuff. Most people don't want to leave their homes. They don't want to leave their culture. They don't want to leave their families. But people were literally forced to. I just had somebody on the show a couple weeks ago, and I'm looking for her name now, Lauren Markham. She wrote a book called Faraway Brothers, which is a really, really very moving book. And it's about the Salvadoran family and the constant, the older brother goes and he makes his way to Berkeley, and then he sends some money, but then he just actually gets in a position where he's not able to send money anymore. The younger brother goes, and then another younger brother goes, and then his sister goes. And each time there's a need. They weren't going to, we can make it big in the U.S. They were going because our family needs it. They need the survival. So, Evelyn, I want to ask you, what do you think about this? What do you think in terms of what is it going to mean?
Well, first of all, it's very sadly, right? The situation we've been through, because we are workers, we contribute to this country. Every 18 months, we had a temporary protected because this benefit we get every 18 months, this provided opportunity to living legally in this country, working legally in this country. So right now we are in a very sad moment, but right now too, we getting strong and united to find another way to get different legal status in this country. And like you mentioned earlier, we already have a family. We already building some status right here, So we adopted a culture of this country. So I beneficiary of temporary protection, so I don't go back to my country. Even though I don't have documents, I stay in this country.
Mm-hmm. Now, here's a question for you, because, one of the things that I kept thinking about is this program apparently has up to 1 million people that have been taking part in it from various parts of the world. And people, and most of those places are places that have been, where the people are living in just total suffering. I mean, it's really, it's not a good scene for people. And, you also have to look at this. You know, I keep thinking about this. There's a million people, and El Salvador is the biggest, in terms of the biggest number of people, the largest grouping of people that have come to this country and are under this temporary protective status. But there's also a lot of people who have come and aren't under that. And it reflects something I think that's really true. That people need to remember that the U.S. had quite a bit to do with the hell that El Salvador has become for so many people living there. You know, it was a big part. I mean, who actually supported the war in El Salvador that meant the death of how many thousands and thousands of people? Who actually is, you know, I mean, it's an incredible, when you look at this, when you look at the gangs that are in El Salvador, most of those gangs, I remember finding this out when I first came to L.A., they came from 18th Street in L.A. and Mara Salvatrucha in L.A., you know, and those gangs were actually homegrown here. And when these kids were deported, they brought that with them. And then life has become a horror for people. Let's talk about that a little.
Well, like you mentioned, our country is living right now insecure with our members, family members that are living over there. So this is the broke system the United States has. So they have to deport our families, put our family in dangerous situation. And the reason is because when these kids with these gangs member, they've been deported, they don't have the second chance we look and send the life, okay? They don't find the job because in my country, as very sadly said, but after the 30 years old, you are so old, you don't find the job. That is the truth, okay? And these gangs member probably they don't find another situation. They has to be living in that situation to bother people, worker families, you know, and they start to create, intimidate our community. So I don't think this is the country I want to go back or my kids want to go back to see their mother.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now we're coming back to you, Julie, because I wanted to talk about this. It's sort of like this program. And what's happening with this? I mean, it's hitting a lot of people, but it's really coming down on El Salvador as the biggest and the sharpest right now. And there's a lot of things that are brought up for questioning here, including, you know, what does it say about this, you know, what's happening to people here? What does it say about what's going to happen to people? There's already tens of thousands of people from El Salvador who are deported regularly. And so you're now looking at that's over 200,000 people who are going to be deported. What is this going to look like in this country? I mean, how do you see it? I mean, already I was reading this morning about ICE raids going on all over the place. How is that going to play itself out?
I mean, I do think that it strips people of important legal protections that have been provided to them for so long. But in all reality, it's not like the U.S. government has the monetary resources to actually put into effect 300,000 deportations. So in all reality, it's not like the program's going to end and all these people are actually going to leave the United States. I just don't think that's practical.
Well, I have two words for you. Donald Trump. Right? You're dealing with a fascist here. People thought that Hitler wasn't going to send millions and millions of people to the gas chambers. This is a reality. I mean, they're fighting this out. They're talking about this now. And again, it's like they're saying to people, like I said, they regularly deport tens of thousands of people from El Salvador. So there's nothing to stop them. In a certain sense, except people standing up and fighting against it from doing this. That's what I think anyway. It's sort of, so we can we can talk.
I do think that the reality of the saturated court systems, especially in areas where TPS holders are concentrated, like Los Angeles, the idea that you could process so many deportations in that short of time just is not realistic. The typical court case here in LA could take 3-5 years appeals. Coincidentally, administration usually takes about 4 years. So I just don't think that it's realistic to think that 263,000 people will leave the U.S. either voluntarily because they've lost their status or through the deportation procedure.
Well, I think they're damn serious about doing it.
I agree that they think that they're.
Yeah, and it could spell a huge. I think it's actually going to spell a huge upheaval in people's lives. I mean, look, it's very. I mean, you. When did you come here?
1992.
So okay, you came here at the same time I came here. Except I came from the East Coast to L.A. But, you know, at that time, I mean, you know how hard it was in terms of people. And that was in the aftermath of the war, and how hard it was to even, like you said, you don't have papers. You're staying here. And, you know, without this temporary protective status, you would have been living in shadows for all of that time. And you've seen raids. I'm sure you've seen raids in various houses and whatnot.
Yeah. You know, I feel strong for whatever is going. I feel strong to fight. To find that way is not just for Evelyn Hernandez to legalize their status more permanently. I feel strong and positive for my community. We are here, you know, we've been for more than 20 years in this country. You know, it's rarely the people I can speak with them and they say, I just have a 19 year, but the majority of us, more than 20 years living in this country, we adopted this country like us, you know, and I don't see myself going back to my country. Yeah, of course, maybe to visit my family, I left there, but not to living in my country.
And once again, I really do want to say this too, because it's actually, look, they are going to try this, I think, but you know, and they're going to try and push it through. But also a lot of what happens depends upon the response that people give to this. The kind of what people standing up and doing something to say no, and not just Salvadoran people, not just people from Haiti or you know, even bringing all the immigrants together, but everyone standing up and saying no. So I want to ask you, Julie, and you can pitch in too, but we have just a couple of minutes and you have, Karesin is having a protest soon around all this. Let's talk about that so people know about it.
Yes, we'll be having a day of action. I'll let Evelyn share a little bit more details about that. But I just want to throw in here that the TPS was created in 1990 because Salvadorans, along with other allies, were organized and they were advocating for inclusion in the political world. So it's not like changes in humanitarian laws are unheard of. So I think that that's what needs to happen now. The U.S. government has a shared responsibility to fix this kind of broken law that they've created, where they let people be on a temporary status for 17 years, 19 years, like that's not temporary anymore. Mm. So I think that now's the time to act, and I think that people are organizing to demand a fair change in the TPS law.
Okay. Elizabeth, we have a minute. How do people find out more information? Who can they call? What can they call?
SaveTPS.com. SaveTPS.com.
Okay, SaveTPS.com.
Yeah.
Right. And they can also go to Karesin's website?
Website or Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We put all the information in our media's page.
That's good. That's just blast it out all over the place.
Yes.
All right. Elizabeth, Julie, thank you very much for joining us today. Julie, do you have anything you want to end with?
No, I just wanted to thank you for having us here today.
Yeah, sure, sure. And we'll stay in touch because we need to follow this. It's a very important, very serious development. So, all right, thank you very much. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we have been talking with Julie Mitchell, managing attorney at Karesin, and Evelyn Hernandez, a TPS holder and organizer. And we've been talking about the Trump regime's latest decision to end temporary protected status, TPS, for Salvadoran immigrants. All right, and just before we sign off, I wanted to stress something that we touched on during our conversation with Julie and Evelyn. You know, it's important that organizations like Karesin and people like Julie and Evelyn are calling on people to stand with the immigrants who are under attack and to protest in the streets, even as they also fight in every legal way possible. Now, I also think that this is not just for immigrant communities, but it's for anyone with a sense of justice. The Trump-Pence regime is not normal, and we all need to step out of our comfort zones. This is a point that Bob Avakian emphasizes in the talk we heard at the beginning of this show, and it's something he'll be speaking more about in the second half of the talk that will air next week. So make sure you tune in. I want to thank all of my guests today. I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my board offer today, Teddy Robinson, and each and every one of you. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And we're going out with Not In Our Name from Savage Rose. Talk to you again next week.